This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears. Tonight we've got two sponsors for the show, the first being Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect and review student work and provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, grades and more. And secondly, our sponsors Jam Software, who provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technology such as Macs, iPads, iPhone and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com, and I'll tell you more about both of those as the show goes on. So tonight is the second of our shows without Bradley. We'll have one more. I'm recording a little bit in advance tonight because on Sunday I am leaving for Dubai to speak at a conference there on the 19th of October. So it'll be just the day after you hear this show. And then a little bit of holiday week and then back to school. So we're going to do one show tonight. This is Tuesday I'm recording this, and we'll record another one for the week after, and then Bradley and I should be back together the week after that. So not much to talk about before we get into the last part of our Diffusion of Innovation series. Just one thing that happened today was that Apple announced new Macs and new so-called Magic peripherals. They've got a new version of the Magic Trackpad, which does force touch on the desktop. They've got a new keyboard, which is kind of halfway between the existing keyboard and the one that's on the MacBook, which is that super thin, super short travel keyboard. And there's also a new Magic Mouse as well. The one thing that I thought was kind of surprising about that was just the sheer price of the Magic Trackpad with the force touch capability for the desktop, which in the UK was coming in around £109, I think, just for the trackpad alone. And in the US, I think it was about $120 or something like that. So I was quite surprised at just how expensive that feature was. But I suppose that's the kind of thing that happens in early generations of technology. So tonight we're going to look at just the final chapter, the 11th and final chapter of the book that we've been looking at for several weeks now, called The Diffusion of Innovations by Everett Rogers. The final chapter is kind of what he does in this chapter is he looks at the current state of, as he does in other parts of the book, he looks at the current state of research in this area on these particular topics, and he sort of looks forward to what should happen in the next generation of research around about innovations. And the point that he makes right at the opening of the chapter is he says that innovation and diffusion are means to an ultimate end. And it's not just innovation for the sake of innovation that people should want, but it's the consequences that result from adopting that innovation. That's why we innovate, and that's why we adopt new technology. So let's say, for example, we're innovating new techniques in heart surgery. The reason for doing that is not simply to have new techniques for heart surgery or to make surgeons more excited when they do surgery, but it's to improve patient outcomes, and it's to gain benefits in terms of health and survivability, or after effects, or recovery time, or whatever it is the most important metric for the benefit of that adoption in hospitals. And similarly in schools, you know, we talk about what are the improvements in student outcomes, not patient outcomes, student outcomes, after adopting certain innovations. So the question then always becomes, well, on what metric is the answer, is the way I always answer that question. People ask all the time, Can you point to benefits that you've received from a one-to-one iPad program? And I say yes, but they don't come in the form of neat numbers. You know, I can't say that we've put 10% on our exam results, or everybody's gone up a grade or whatever. Partly for the simple reason that our sample size is too small to really make those claims in a serious way, but also because I think that many of the benefits that we have received from having an iPad program in school are not very well measured by normal metrics that we use for the benefit that you get from going to school. So we look at things like exam results, number of passes at certain levels. We look at the proportion of students who passed at certain levels and so on. And I don't think that all of the things that we see as teachers, our professional judgment is captured by those numbers. And we look at things like confidence or employability skills or higher order thinking skills, analytical skills, presentation skills. Many of those things are just not measured by the exam system at all. And that's always, when it comes down to what's the benefit, you've got to ask yourself, measured on what metric? I think that's something just worth bearing in mind as you look at any innovation, is what benefit will it bring? Well, it will certainly change things, but you have to decide as well how you're going to actually measure that change. and whether or not, you know, if you're only being measured on one metric, which might be exam results, maybe the only thing that's worth doing is something that changes that number. Because if what you do doesn't change that number, then, you know, maybe it's going to be very hard for you to demonstrate the benefit of the innovation. But what Roger says in this chapter is he says that, in fact, consequences of innovations are relatively little studies. But he calls on researchers or diffusers, really, to take more responsibility for the consequences of their efforts. We talked right back at the start of this series about a thing called the pro-innovation bias, which is that conscious or unconscious assumption by diffusers and change agents, and even in some cases adopters, that adopting the innovation is ipso facto a good thing, and there are no negative consequences, or there's nothing will negatively change as a result of adopting the innovation. That innovation is good and should be adopted, and that is in itself a good thing. And what he says in this chapter is that's not always the case. He does admit that predicting the consequences of an innovation is always difficult and often impossible, but that they do exist. And he asks, really, at the beginning of the chapter, he asks why it is that there are so few studies of consequences, and gives a few answers and tries to kind of frame it this way. He says that, firstly, it's often the change agencies that sponsor diffusion research, and they tend to overemphasize adoption, assuming the results will be positive, because that's what change agencies are for. Their entire existence is based on the idea that innovations exist, and it's their job to get them out to the world. And if they do that, they have succeeded in the task that was set for them. And they're often the people who sponsor diffusion research. So there's a bit of a question mark about perhaps the neutrality of some of that research there, where at least in terms of selecting the research question, because the people who are paying for the research to happen often look at things in a certain way and don't always consider the negative side of things. The second reason that Rogers gives for the fact that there are so few studies of consequences is that the usual techniques used to survey adoption are different from the techniques required to observe these kinds of changes over an extended period of time. So whereas you can drop in a questionnaire that says, when did you first learn about this kind of car, and when did you decide to buy one, and what actions did you take in the meantime? That's a kind of survey-based thing that you can do. He says that the consequences question is not adequately addressed by just adding another question to that survey. What you often have to do is use a completely different toolkit of research, which often comes more from ethnographic studies than from surveys or market research as such. And it's sometimes the case that diffusion researchers don't necessarily have the skill set that they need to do those kind of long-term studies after adoption has been widespread. He says also that consequences are hard to measure. And one of the reasons for that is that studies of consequence are often based on self-reported measures by respondents. And these people might not be aware of all the consequences. You have to try and get a broad enough base of people, but then people themselves might not be aware of what has actually happened until perhaps, you know, decades or even generations after the innovation has come along. You know, look at what has come from that and then take it from there. He also says that cultural differences between researchers and studied groups can cause difficulties in determining the benefit or otherwise of an innovation. So sometimes you might see something happening that doesn't look like a benefit or looks like a negative consequence, but actually if you understood the cultural context better, you would have a better idea of why that thing is actually the way it is. And finally, that the consequences of the innovation can sometimes be confounded by other effects. So if you look in, for example, the field of agriculture, you might see lower yields in a couple of years after an innovation was adopted. But he says that the reasons for that might be other than just because of the innovation. You know, because nothing happens in a vacuum. You can't just change one thing and have nothing else change at the same time. So another example, you know, from my own experience is where we became a one-to-one school at the same time as a period of radical curriculum change. And that was kind of perhaps from the last show, if you remember, and don't let a good crisis go to waste. That was perhaps what I was doing there. But if you look at the outcomes now, you could say, well, some of that's due to the computer deployment, and some of that's due to the change in curriculum. And I will quite freely admit that I think that I discovered, over the course of our nearly six years of iPad deployment now, that we changed the computer part first, But what happened then was that it changed other parts of the school. And one of the things that I personally had to change a lot was my approach to teaching and move it sort of further up the hierarchy of Bloom's taxonomy, if you like, and make it more about those higher order skills and much less about remembering facts and remembering dates and things that could typically be computerized quite easily. So there are certainly two effects going on there, and I think actually both of them have played off against each other very nicely to produce very good results in those kinds of higher order skills and employability skills and so on. But it's hard to tease apart exactly which part is due to which. And I actually think it's you sort of need both, you know, they're necessary but not sufficient. That having computers freely available has been a great benefit to the school, but also having a very progressive constructivist curriculum at the same time. The two of those things fit together really nicely. And personally, I think it's hard to see how you could kind of deliver the full vision of Scotland's curriculum without a lot of access to computers. Now, that's partly because of that cultural context, that we just live in an era where computers are everywhere and constant companions. And if you took a progressive constructivist curriculum and put it back in time, you would do it differently. You could still do it, but you would do it differently. But I think it's just the fact that the computer is, you know, it is the intellectual instrument of our generation, that, you know, computers and constructivist education go together very, very nicely when you approach them that way. Let me take a moment and talk to you about Shobi. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. And with Shobi, what you can do is you can assign, collect and review student work on students' iPads. And then you, as a teacher, can provide feedback directly into their documents with annotation features such as pen tools and voice notes and so on. Students can show their learning by submitting to Shobi from thousands of iPad apps or by using Shobi's built-in tools. New to Shobi this year is the gradebook feature for Shobi Pro, which allows teachers to easily add, review and export student grades. More great features like student portfolios and parent access are coming to Shobi this fall. Shobi Basic is 100% free, and individual teachers listening to this podcast will get gradebook and the enhanced annotation features of Shobi Pro for 30% off if they purchase annually. Start your paperless classroom today by downloading Shobi in the App Store or by visiting shobi.com. Okay, so let's take a look at some of the other things that Roger says about consequences. And in some ways, I think this part of the book is a little bit weak, perhaps. That may be a little bit unfair of me to say, but it just seems a little bit obvious to it. I mean, maybe it's because I've been through cycles of innovation that these things kind of seem obvious to me, but he does call them out, and I suppose it's partly for completeness that these things come together in the book. But he talks about a classification of consequences along three different axes. He talks about desirable versus undesirable consequences, direct versus indirect consequences, and anticipated versus unanticipated consequences. And I think that many of us will look at those and go, well, duh, that's obvious. You know, of course there are desirable and undesirable consequences. And of course there are direct versus indirect consequences. And to be honest, Rogers doesn't say a whole lot about some of those things. He talks about desirable and undesirable consequences, and he gives some very, you know, almost kind of harrowing tales of innovation. He talks about a story about the adoption of snowmobiles for reindeer herding in the Arctic and the incredibly bad consequences that arose from the change from traditional herding methods to motorized herding in the Arctic. But what he says is that desirable consequences are functional effects of an innovation, and undesirable consequences are dysfunctional effects. He talks also about windfall profits and windfall losses. And those profits, I mean, we kind of know of these phrases. You talk about like windfall profits and taxes with big businesses who have a very good year, and the government sort of comes along and says, well, maybe I'll just take some of that profit because you've had a good year. Oil companies, for example. And sometimes, to be fair, you know, sometimes the governments prop up those companies in the bad times as well. So maybe that's fair overall. But one of the interesting things, the way that Rogers frames the idea of windfall profits is that these profits are benefits gained from being the first to adopt a new system, where your costs drop relative to everyone else, while the cost of the thing that you do as a whole, the asset that you produce, let's say oil, for example, stays high until everyone adopts that technology. And you can see, you know, that kind of thing, it's almost like arbitrage over time. So what can happen is that you can, you can adopt something first and you get something really cheap until everybody adopts it, and then the cost goes up again, or the cost has to rebalance because not everybody can be getting the benefit you are. And I'm kind of right in the fork of this problem right now with having adopted an electric car a year ago. So when I first got my car last year, it was great because there are charging points everywhere and they're all free to use, and it's great, and I can drive. You know, I drove from Greenock to York last year, just about this time last year, and I drove probably about 600 or 700 miles for about £2. And I charged the car when I left the house, and I charged that again when I came home, and I certainly charged it many, many times when I was out and about in that long trip. But I didn't pay anything for any of those charges because they were all free to early adopters of electric cars. But what's happening right now is that I'm increasingly finding in places like Glasgow that there is charging infrastructure, and there's more and more of it as time goes on. But it's increasingly getting busy because more people are adopting electric cars. And it's starting to get difficult to find a free charger when you need one. So what's going to happen is that I've had a year of a really nice benefit of easy access to free, basically free petrol, if you like, for my car. But what's going to happen is that as more people adopt, and eventually as everybody adopts, we're going to have to find new ways of regulating access to that facility, which is probably, you know, maybe the easiest and most straightforward way to do it is just to charge people for charging their car. I mean, we don't give away petrol for free, so why give away electricity for free? Okay, the cost is lower and there are other benefits to getting people to adopt. But, you know, the way I look at that actually is one of the biggest problems with charging electric car right now, and particularly in Scotland, it seems, is that the model of rapid charger that they've chosen to put out for electric cars is a very unreliable model. And the bigger problem is not that you can't find the charger, but that it might be broken when you get there. And that's something that I think if those chargers were making £5 a time, those would all be working all the time. And I think that's something that is probably going to happen over time. So I've had that windfall benefit for a year in driving an electric car, but that benefit's starting to taper off as more pressure comes on these charging points, for example. You can also get windfall losses, and this is something that happens particularly in fields that are dominated by Moore's Law. But if anything that's sort of standardized, if you back the wrong horse, basically, if you're the, I'm going to date myself with this analogy, but if you're the guy who bought Betamax when VHS won the day, or let's say you're the guy who bought HD DVD when Blu-ray won the day, and I certainly had this when we first adopted iPads, that some of the people who a couple of years previously had bought netbooks when iPads started to really take over the sort of next generation computer device for schools, I had some very unhappy things said about the choice of iPad in that time. And once you sort of scratched away at the surface a little bit and you found out who these people were and where they were coming from, turns out these were the people who had just adopted netbooks and they were not happy, and they were sort of taken out on the iPad. So you can have a windfall loss too. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, if you go back to the innovativeness and adopter categories material, the people who are early innovators and early adopters have to be more wealthy and have more slack resources than people who adopt later, because they have to be able to finance the risk of occasionally backing the wrong horse when it comes to technology. One of the quotes I like from Rogers in this chapter is he says that the effects of an innovation usually cannot be managed so as to separate the desirable from the undesirable consequences, which is a way of saying take the rough with the smooth, really. And I think that for people, take it back to the school computer adoption problem that we're all dealing with again. Can we promise our management, can we promise our parents that nothing bad will ever happen? No. And I think what you see more and more is that the schools who try and arrange their deployment so that they can say with a high degree of confidence that even if it's not 100%, they can say with, you know, maybe 90% confidence nothing bad will ever happen. What happens is that they end up limiting their deployment so much that they don't get the desirable consequences as well, as a result of having avoided the undesirable consequences, if you like. And interestingly, the example that Rogers gives in this chapter is about the sort of old order Amish communities again, who have deliberately and quite consciously foregone all the positive benefits of many technological innovations over many, many years in order to avoid what they see as the undesirable consequences. And it would be a shame, I think, for us to see schools go down the route of essentially becoming sort of Amish communities of practice because they don't want the undesirable consequences of computer adoption or high degrees of computer adoption, should we say. Of course, many schools have got computers, but not that many schools are one-to-one. And is it the right decision for us to not strive for one-to-one just because we're concerned about the undesirable consequences? Or do we, for example, do we defend our deployments so closely that we don't even get the desirable benefits? One just simple micro example, if you like, is I remember dealing with a number of schools who were doing iPad deployments, and their insurance company had told them that they had to put, if you know these OtterBox cases or these Defender cases, the sort of military spec, real big, rugged, fat cases you can put on iPads, their insurance company had mandated that they put that case on their iPad. And one of the things that they sort of realized the students were struggling with was that this case, actually destroyed many of the practical benefits of adopting a tablet computer in the first place. It made it incredibly difficult to handle. It made it very heavy by comparison to the iPad with a normal case on it. And it made it much less easy to use. And they were actually losing some of the positive benefits of adopting iPad because they were trying so hard to avoid the undesirable consequences. And what Roger says here is really that you can't actually separate those two things enough. So you just have to be prepared for there to be some undesirable consequences as well as desirable consequences at the end of the day. Rogers also talks about direct versus indirect consequences, but he doesn't really talk about this in a very, I don't find it a very convincing way. He just sort of puts it in there for completeness, I think. And he says basically that if you adopt one innovation to solve one problem, you may create another, or you can create a sort of consequential problem or an indirect problem. He gives an example of using oral rehydration therapy to help children in developing regions not develop diarrhea and then not proceed to dehydrate and then die as a consequence of that disease, which is obviously desirable, I think. But what he says then is because some of those programs had been so successful, mortality rates declined rapidly and populations grew quickly, and then it put incredible pressure on later stage healthcare systems and then school systems and other parts of the infrastructure. So that solving one problem, infant mortality, actually created a number of other problems further down the line. Now, I think we can all agree that those are good problems to have, but that doesn't make them not problems. And I think this is one of the things you have to sort of consider as you go is, let's say you're going to adopt computers. What are you going to do? What are the consequences of that going to be? And what are the indirect consequences going to be? A simple and sort of obvious one is like you may well have to increase the bandwidth available to your school. You may also have to look at Wi-Fi provision. The classic problem that many schools deal with is that the people in charge only understood about signal coverage and not density. So what you find is that, okay, I can see 4 bars on my computer, but because there's 50 of us in this room trying to all talk to one access point, the Wi-Fi still isn't working. So things like that, those kind of indirect consequences, that's not that indirect. But you can think of other ones like where do we put our bags at interval? Can we still use the same bag system? Can we leave our bags here? Is it safe? Is it secure? Is there going to be damage because of where the bags are? Do we keep our bags outside? Do we now have to start keeping them inside because there might be an iPad in them? Things like that. And then later, and this is one thing that, to be fair, many schools are very good at identifying, is there then a security risk to our children walking home because we become known as the school that has iPads? And these are some of the questions that you have to balance off depending on your local context and your local situation. The final pair of consequences that Rogers talks about is anticipated versus unanticipated consequences. And what he says is that anticipated consequences are those changes due to an innovation that are recognized and intended by the members of a social system. And the unanticipated consequences are the ones that are neither intended nor recognized by the members of a system. He later says that unanticipated consequences can represent a lack of understanding of how an innovation functions and of the internal and external forces at work in a social system. And I've certainly seen this myself when I've helped schools with iPad programs where they have created unanticipated consequences because they simply didn't have the technical understanding for how it worked. And one of the biggest situations where that happens, I think, is when it comes to designing an Apple ID deployment and then deploying apps through your system. And what I find often is that schools simply don't understand how Apple IDs work. They don't understand what volume purchase can do for them, and they don't understand how an MDM server and managed distribution can help them. And often, I mean, I've been to schools where I know of places where there are literally thousands of iPads operating off one Apple ID, for example. I know of other places where teacher iPads have been set up with one school Apple ID, and a teacher has to go and find a systems administrator in order to download any app. And there are decisions that are made, but the unintended consequences of those decisions might be that you end up just destroying your deployment somewhere later along in the system. And the thing about, I've always found with iPad, about going against recommended best practice from Apple is that Apple feels no compunction against breaking a deployment that doesn't follow its rules. So if you are the deployment that has 5,000 iPads on one Apple ID, there's a great risk that maybe one day Apple decides, okay, we're going to enforce a limit of three devices per Apple ID, let's say. And you're just, let's face it, screwed at that point. And your deployment requires a complete rethink and a complete reboot. And similarly, if you're the deployment where you have a systems administrator intervention required for a teacher to download an app, one of the unanticipated consequences of that, well, it's not that unanticipated because I can imagine it right now, is that the rate of innovation in your teachers is going to be much, much lower than if they could download an app themselves. Now, I say that I can anticipate that problem, but it's all relative to the people who are involved in the social system. I wasn't involved in that decision, although I learned about it later. And had I been involved, I would have anticipated that consequence because I knew enough to know not to do that. But the people involved at that time, whether they didn't have the technical knowledge or they didn't have the organizational foresight to realize that, I don't know. I don't want to comment on that. But the point being that that seems like a good idea until you try it, and then there are unintended consequences along with it. Rogers says that uncertainty about new innovations can never be completely removed. And one of the ways in which you can do your best with that is you can try and talk to other people who have been there before you and learn from their mistakes and their successes. And that's a really strong way to do it. So if you are planning something like this, going and visiting and speaking to other schools is a great way to start to learn about the sort of brass tacks of what goes right and what goes wrong when you're trying to do a deployment. Rogers also admits that change agents cannot know the unanticipated consequences until after widespread adoption has occurred. It's those things that you don't know that you don't know. And you don't necessarily know how people are going to react. You don't know how they're going to behave in these change situations. And sometimes things are just radically different to what you think. What he does is he breaks down innovations into three aspects, and he talks about which ones are diffusible and which ones are not. He talks about form, function, and meaning. Form being the directly observable physical appearance and substance of an innovation. And you could look at that by saying, well, we are adopting tablet computers in our school. And people who are sort of focused on the form can come and look at a school that's an iPad school and they can say, well, if we just get tablet computers as well, we will have the success that this school has had. Now, that's a fundamental attribution error, but it is the way that some people think about this problem, is that they think that if we get anything that's shaped like a tablet, we're going to get the same benefit. It seems to me obvious that it's far more complex than that, but I have had that experience where people think, well, you get tablets, we get tablets. You know, your school is one-to-one iPad. Our school has got 6 Kindle Fires in it. Why aren't we getting the same results? Okay, thinking, well, yep, there's a lot more to it than just the form. The function is the contribution made by an innovation to the way of life of members of a social system. So the difference there is between having some tablets in the school and having a consistent, widespread, modern, supported deployment of computers available for everybody. And that's something that I think can make a big, big difference. the change in the way of life, the change in the culture of the school, rather than just we've got some of the same things you've got, therefore we should have the same results, when in fact that's very rarely, if ever, the case that that happens. Finally, there's meaning, the meaning of an innovation. And the meaning is described as a subjective and frequently unconscious perception of an innovation by members of a social system. We sort of touched on this last week when we talked about the idea that iPads can be brought into school for a single purpose, and sometimes that means that the meaning just becomes that purpose that was stated at the start. If you give people the meaning of your innovation, then they're not going to construct it for themselves in the way that is most powerful. Rogers quotes another researcher called Linton from 1936, who says, because of its subjective nature, meaning is much less susceptible to diffusion than form or function. A receiving culture attaches new meanings to the borrowed elements of complexes, and these may have little relation to the meanings which the same elements carried in the original setting. And that's where it becomes difficult to go to one school and say, well, we're going to buy the same thing you bought, therefore we'll get the same results. It's a lot more complicated than that, and it's not just about the form or even just about the function of the device, but it's also about the meaning that you've constructed culturally in the school as well. And that's kind of the difference between becoming an iPad school and becoming a one-to-one iPad school that deeply embeds the use of the device in the lesson. Anybody can go and buy computers, but embedding them into the culture is a much longer term job. It's a much harder job. It's a much more boring job, quite frankly. And it involves a lot of hand holding and a lot of sitting down and a lot of cajoling and all the kind of leadership skills that we know to get your whole culture changed around to construct a new meaning for this device. It's beyond just what is it and what can it do for us. And that's the real big challenge, I think. And I think over in my experience of deploying computers one-to-one, I think that in the early days, I probably looked at the whole situation, I said, the iPad is the thing. I certainly probably thought that in the beginning. And what I realized over time, maybe 2 or 3 years in, was that it wasn't the iPad as much as it was the one-to-one. And I say this quite frequently now when I present, that if you leave my presentation thinking that iPad is the game changer and not what being one-to-one, then I've done something wrong in my presentation. I think that's the thing that actually makes the game-changing difference, is just having sufficient numbers of computers, sufficient free access to them. And of course, there are other things that have to change as well, but those are the key game changers for me, rather than just we got some tablets in the school and therefore we expect magic things to happen. Let me take a moment and tell you about Jam Software. Jam Software provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technology such as Macs, iPads, iPhone and Apple TV in education. And now with Casper Focus, they have placed these great technologies directly into the hands of teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select the specific Apple TV assigned to their class, and choose and distribute iBooks. They can even initiate AirPlay right from Casper Focus. You can learn more about what you can do with Casper Focus at jamfsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. Now, let me close this up with two final points that Rogers makes. One is about equilibrium, and one is about equality. Equilibrium is a question about what rate of change allows a system to achieve the maximum benefits from an innovation without producing disequilibrium in the social system that surrounds it, or disharmony or friction or inefficiency or whatever you want to call it. Rogers talks about a social system having a stable equilibrium, which is a situation where there's almost no change in the structure or functioning of the social system. And as a result, the rate of change is almost zero. It could be a little bit more than zero, but basically nothing much is changing. And you can think back to those communities like the Amish community who really haven't changed their form of lifestyle in many, many, many years because there's almost no change in the structure or functioning of their social system, and there's really no major innovations happening in that community. Disequilibrium, on the other hand, is when the rate of change is too rapid to allow a social system to adjust. The change is happening, and as a result of that, you get social disorder, and it's a painful and inefficient way for change to occur, when you drive through too much change and you don't give people time to adjust. And you quite often hear in education a lot of the time teachers asking for more time to do things, more time to make changes, more time to adjust to changes. And I think sometimes, I don't want to say that those requests are never well-founded, because sometimes I think they are, but also I think that you could give some teachers any amount of time and they would still say, oh, I need another year, I need another 6 months to adopt this or whatever. And sometimes claims that the rate of change is too rapid is, you know, you can end up just never changing things. And it's maybe it's a call to get back to stable equilibrium. And in some ways, I think, you know, should we just ram through change and then take some time to cope with the consequences afterwards? Or should we stagger change out? And I think one of the things that I've seen in our school is I've seen some teachers get risk of burned out, or risk getting burned out, I should say. That was terrible grammar. But you can get innovation overload. You can have too many things to cope with, one after the other after the other. And we had, you know, we had iPad deployments, then we had, while we were having a changing curriculum, and then we had new exam systems coming in. And I think, you know, just now we're kind of coming out the other end of all of that change, and we're looking at a period where, you know, maybe in the next development cycle for the school, things just necessarily have to cool down a bit, because otherwise people are going to start cracking up because there's just another thing to cope with and another thing and another thing. And that is the job of leadership, I think, is one of those areas, is just to jump in there and say, okay, at some point we're going to have to just take a break. And I don't mean just sit and do nothing, but I mean you can have radical transformational change and then you do tidying up work afterwards. And then you've got that kind of TikTok approach to development planned in schools or whatever. And I think that could be healthy. And it's important for leaders and digital leaders not to burn people out on change. And it's your job to editorialize change so that what happens is you only burn your goodwill with people, if you like, when you've got something that really needs to be changed. And we talked before about the difference between innovators and early adopters. Innovators are the people who come back from conferences and go, we need to adopt this, 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 and this. And early adopters are the people who carefully think about what they've seen and they suggest maybe we should do this one thing. And those early adopters get more respect from the community. They lead more people with them than those innovators who are sort of hyperactive about change. And I think it's key when you end up with this a higher rate of change that you have to carefully manage that and not let people get burned out over the course of that as well. Finally, I'm going to talk about equality. And what Roger says about equality is he talks about there being two aspects to how much good there is in a system, and whether it's a job of innovation to increase the overall amount of good or to make it more evenly distributed. Now, we know that earlier adopters gain benefits that later adopters don't get. And we also know that there are socioeconomic differences between early and late adopters. And what Roger says is that it's likely that diffusion programs may exacerbate those differences, however temporarily, possibly in the long term. But what he says is that because essentially the more wealthy and educated people have more contact with change agents, any diffusion program will probably affect those people first, and more than the people who are less educated, less wealthy, take longer to decide, take longer to adopt. And I think this is one area where the book shows its age a little bit, which is that he talks about the internet and he talks about how there's a growing digital divide between people who have the internet and those who don't. And I think when you look at that in 2015, you look at that and you think, well, is there really such a great digital divide in our world right now? When you look at people in sub-Saharan Africa, who there are more people in that region of the world, one of the poorest in the whole world, who have access to cellular networks than have access to improved water or sanitation. And in that, you know, digital is becoming so compelling, internet access is becoming so compelling and so critical to so many people's lives, even the poorest. In fact, perhaps impacting the poorest people more. If they can get online, it has more chance of transforming their life than it does somebody who's already wealthy in a Western country. But I was thinking about that in the context of schools. And the one thing about schools that makes it different from other social systems to adopt is that, particularly in a school managed deployment, it's not up to the individual when they adopt. And if you're planning a deployment for a school, one of the things you have to think about is whether or not it is in fact ethical for you to decide when people get to be adopters. And what I mean by that is there are different models of taking a school from nothing to one-to-one. And one of the ones that's quite common, although I don't think it's very good, is the idea that we'll buy new iPads for every new first-year group that comes into the secondary school. And then over the course of 5 or 6 years, we'll become a one-to-one school. If you think about what you're doing there, what you're doing is you're saying that the youngest year group in the school get to adopt first, and that that everybody who's already in your school never gets to adopt. So your first years become your second years, then you buy new computers for your new first year group, and then these people become adopters, and the people who were already in your school never get to adopt. And the question is, given, you, obviously, if you're going to adopt computers, you must think there are benefits to doing so. Is it ethical to deny those benefits to the people who are not getting to adopt? That's a question I think people have to ask themselves. There's a lot of other things wrong with that deployment model. I'll not go into them all right now, but I think that's something that is worth thinking about. Is it fair to force the consequences of late adoption onto students who maybe want to be adopters much earlier? I'm pretty sure if you surveyed the students in your school, you would find that most of them don't want to be late adopters. But what you're essentially saying in that step-by-step, year-on-year rollout is you second, third, fourth, and fifth years, you get to be laggards. And the first years get to be early adopters, and we'll have nothing in between, because the adoption decision is not up to the individual, it's up to the organization. And it's something to be very careful about, I think, is it fair to deny some people the benefits while giving it to others in the school? So let me wrap this up. I mean, what we're really thinking about here, what we're talking about is what happens next, right? What are the consequences? What's going to happen once we make this decision? And I think that the message that I get out of this is that we can't always know all the consequences. There will be many good consequences that you anticipate. There will be many good consequences you don't anticipate. And there will be negative consequences either way. But what we do know is that there are, shall we say, known unknowns. I like to sometimes finish these things with quoting the great Donald Rumsfeld, who gave that amazing statement, which I think anybody who's been involved in an uncertain project like a computer deployment in schools really identifies with. And Rumsfeld said that reports that say something hasn't happened are always interesting to me, because as we know, there are known knowns. There are things that we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. There are also unknown unknowns, the ones that we don't know that we don't know, which may be some difficult and tricky language just to even read out, never mind think about. But at the heart of it, that idea that there are unknown unknowns and there are known unknowns and there are known knowns, if you like, you need to know what all of those are. And one of the ways in which you can learn a bit more of those is by talking to other people that can help you. People who've been there before, people who've done it before, and people who share their expertise with you. This podcast is one way that I can do that, and Bradley can do that as well. And, you know, if you know people who are thinking about this, maybe pointing them to our podcast would be a great way to help them learn a little bit more about it. And of course, going to visit other schools that may be local to you or further afield, talking to them, taking their advice, and of course, talking to Apple as well. I mean, if you're going iPad, Google, if you're going Chromebook, they've seen many of these kind of deployments before. They'll be able to advise you as well. The key thing, though, is to make sure you've covered all the ones you can anticipate with and deal with the rest as you go on. It's not the end of the world if something bad goes wrong. You shouldn't shut down your deployment just because something bad happened. You deal with it, you move on. Same as with every other part of the school. And if I can kind of leave you with that one idea, that's it. That it's not the end of the world if something bad goes wrong. There will be consequences, good and bad. Try and notice the good ones, the ones you didn't expect. Notice them and celebrate them, but deal with the bad ones as well. And with goodwill on all sides, these things can be made to work. So with that, that's the end of our Diffusion of Innovation series. I hope it's been useful. Please send us any feedback you want. There's a comment box at outofschool.net. You can do that there. You can leave us a review on iTunes. We love to read the reviews that we get there. Rating the show on iTunes really helps as well. If you're using the new Overcast 2.0 podcast client on iOS, you can recommend individual shows on that, or you can recommend the whole show. And that really helps as well, because that brings us higher up in their directory of things that other people might browse and discover the show that way as well. And of course, sharing it on Twitter and social networks is awesome. So we appreciate any ways that you can help other people get the benefit of the advice that's on the show. We would love to hear from you as well. And if you've enjoyed this series, please let us know. And if there's things you want to hear about in the future, please let us know that too. Until next time, I am Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web, and Bradley will be back with us in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening.